distance, the moonlight off their sabres matching the stark white lights that Oswald's pirates had erected. I have heard that 8 in 10 of them were cut down by devices launched on the perimeter of the camp. The tent collapsed, and something caught me on the side of the head once more. I saw Holmes look at me with concern. His face had an expression of decision on it, and then I saw nothing more. I woke in the Dragoon barracks. They had surprised Oswald's men enough to force a swift retreat. Their craft had taken them off, but had not been tracked as well by astonished observers as it had in its flight to Dorking. I knew I had to leave. I took a train to London, having wired ahead to some friends in the major hospitals. When I got there, I received word that what I feared was so, that my darling was indeed gone, the victim of 2 bullets when she tried to prevent the manhandling me out of the window. I visited her home and saw what was left, and then I knew not what to do. Holmes, I was sure, had left me to save me. He was Oswald's main quarry. Surely he would attempt to take the brigands somewhere out of the city, where the pursuit would be a contest between them and him, and not cost innocent lives. He might subtly suggest to them a place where he might be found, somewhere featured in my writings, and then turn the tables. I could not return home, or go to my practice, to places where they would know to find me. I could not stay in the streets I had often described. I was sure, with the inventions they had to hand, that they could find me there too. So I found my abandoned place of darkness, broke in, and sat to think, and now to write. And there is where my account fails me, and time catches up with words. I hope that you will read this, old friend. I hope that your place in our world, the necessity of you, will be affirmed by this account rather than undermined. I fear that I have written of you once again, but I have written of the real Sherlock Holmes, not the chimera that Oswald imagines him to be. I have done my best to make my subjectivity into an object that will survive me, and I have sent it to an audience that I love. I am certain that your battle with these forces will be worthy of you. I wait to see what, by the grace of God, will save us. Here the journal of Dr. John H. Watson ends. Holmes comes into view in the crosshairs of the sights of the device. He stands looking intently over the grassy knolls of the great Grimpen Mire across from the shooter, oblivious. He wears an Inverness cape and a deerstalker, and in his mouth is clutched a briar pipe. In his hands he holds a magnifying glass. Perhaps the perfection of the sight is what makes Oswald hesitate. His finger is on the trigger. He hesitates. His men are spread out along the route they thought Holmes would have to take. They are all lone gunmen now, the helicopter left back at the hall. He hears and feels something land in the dip behind him. He turns. Not in time. Professor Moriarty is upon him, silently, a long medical blade in his hand. He wears his opera cape. His top hat is on his head. His gleaming eyes and wild grin shove themselves into Oswald's face. One huge, brutishly intelligent hand throws the technology aside. "Thank you," he tells Oswald, "for setting me free." Oswald sees the blade enter him. There is no pain for such a long moment. Not until Moriarty's hand jerks it expertly, back and to the left. The Deerstalker was written by Paul Cornell and read by Andrew Sachs. It was directed and produced.